This is Equisport News. Brought to you by Bally Rose Farm. Your South Florida full-service farm and bloodstock agency. Now here are your hosts, Les Salzman and Alora Allen.
Hey, and a good afternoon to you from South Florida. This is Les Salzman, and with me is Alora Allen. And I'm thrilled today because we've got two of my favorite people in the horse industry, Frank Taylor and his son, Joe Taylor, who both have become excellent friends and good buddies over the last few years. Guys, welcome aboard and congratulations on an amazing sale at Keeneland September.
Thank you so much. We're thrilled to be on here. Appreciate you inviting us.
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk with you guys and learn from you as well. Joe, you've done a great job with one of our clients, and you know the quality of service has been so tremendous. And Allure's actually been reading your grandfather's book the last couple of weeks, and I got to tell you, I think it all springs back from the lessons he taught. Frank, what do you think?
Yeah, my dad, he was an amazing guy. He was a great horseman, and he was a big thinker and a very very creative, and was always looking for a better way. And he kind of instilled that into all his sons and now his grandsons. So yeah, we were blessed to have a dad like Joe Taylor, and he really set us up for success.
Hey, could you just give us a little bit of background to the Taylor family? Because, you know, everybody thinks that in Kentucky, people were born rich and into this sport of kings. But that wasn't the case in the Taylor family.
No, that was the opposite with us. So my grandfather was Dan Taylor, and he had a farm down in Frankfort, Kentucky. And he had a big family. He had 12 kids, and they were farmers, and they raised tobacco and cattle, and then they also got into raising standardbred horses. And so my father was raised around that environment, and he learned to be a good farmer and a good horseman at an early age. Matter of fact, he only went to sixth grade because his father got sick for a period of time, and he had to go run the farm when he was in sixth grade. So he just had to do that for a couple of years, and then never went back. But we've been a blessed family and a big family. So my dad was one of 12, and then I'm one of 8, and there's 4 brothers that started TaylorMade and own it now with our kids. Joe, my son Joe, owns a piece of TaylorMade, and so does my daughter Katie. And there's 4 brothers. There's Duncan, Ben, and Mark, and myself. And we've all got kids in the business. So we're moving into the third generation, and they're doing a great job. And it's a lot of excitement. My dad went to work for the Gaines family, Clarence Gaines, who was in the standardbred business, and he went to work as a groom there. And within a year or two, he was the farm manager, and that was a very successful standardbred operation. And then after that, John Gaines, his son, graduated from college, and they switched over to thoroughbreds, and my dad went to work for John Gaines. And they did some amazing things, very innovative. They started the Breeders' Cup. They started Kentucky Horse Park. They started syndicating stallions and first people to ever put mares under lights or palpate mares, or just very, very innovative. And TaylorMade got its start kind of during those times. When TaylorMade started, I was 13 and my oldest brother, Duncan, was 19. And we just kind of got rolling, and TaylorMade's grown into a lot bigger business than we ever dreamed, but we've just been very, very blessed.
Well, you know, it's very interesting because Allure, as I mentioned, has been reading your dad's book, and just the way you kind of told the story The book almost tells the story of how to be successful in the thoroughbred business. And I'm wondering, do you guys refer back to it?
We do. We pretty much know it by heart, so we don't have to
I
refer
would
back.
think at this stage of the
It
game, right?
was drilled into us. You know, my dad, he was a workaholic for sure. You know, he worked 18-hour days on a regular basis. But the good thing about him is he was a workaholic, but he took his kids to work with him because he could. He wasn't in an office or in a setting. He was out there on a farm working, so he was able to take all his kids with him and teach us a lot at an early age. And once somebody asked my dad, said, Joe said, how do you afford so many kids? He said, I've made money out of every one of them. And he really did. He taught us to work hard and taught us a lot of stuff early. And, you know, when I was 16, the yearling manager at Gainesway left abruptly, and my dad made me yearling manager at Gainesway when I was 16 years old for a couple of years. So he would throw you in the deep end and see how well you am, and then throw you a preserver if you needed one. But yeah, he was all about teaching, and he taught us all to be workaholics, which has been had a lot of positives and a few negatives. But work ethic is not an issue around here.
Now, you know, we always talk about your dad. Tell us a little bit about your mom.
Well, she was really behind the scenes, made things happen. She was an amazing lady. I always tell everybody jokingly, we were born under a lot of pressure because my dad's named Joseph, my mom's named Mary. So I got a lot of expectations, but anyway, my mom was an amazing lady. She loved my dad, and she waited on him and served him. You know, she just loved being a mom and loved being a wife. She actually never drove a car. She had eight kids. She stayed there and she took care of us. And I mean, three big meals a day, and that was just what she loved to do. You know, she never left the house much until she'd go to church on Sunday, and then my dad'd take her, and they'd go grocery shopping. And other than that, she was just there raising eight kids all the time. And the thing about us is all us kids never went to anybody else's house. They always came over to us. So it was not uncommon to have 20 or 30 kids in that house at a time. So she was just a very dedicated wife and mom, and she was really the backbone that kind of held everything together.
The reason I kind of asked that question, and it was kind of a loaded question because I thought I knew the answer, is that's the way the tailor-made operation is today. It's one large extended family. You've got guys that have been working there for, well, since Duncan and Mark got it started.
Yeah, it's really a family operation. You know, I always jokingly say my brother Duncan, he came up with this tagline for TaylorMade that we treat all our horses, our customers, and our employees like family. And I jokingly said, "Hell, Duncan, we got to treat them better than that." But yeah, it's just a big family here. All our customers, I mean, we got customers that been with us 40, 50 years, and we got customers that are working with us in the third generation. You know, we work for their grandparents, their parents, and we're working for the kids now. So yeah, we try to really make it a very much a family operation, and we treat all the people that work for us and work with us like they're just part of our family.
Now, Joe, you're part of the next gen, but I see the same work ethic with you that I see with your dad and the rest of the operation. How's that get transferred to you? Is he a pretty good dad?
He is
I'm
very
sitting
good,
next to
Dad.
you, so He's sitting
Yes.
right next to you, so I don't expect a negative answer.
I better leave so he can answer that honestly.
No, he's a great dad. Much like my grandfather, Frank never liked to watch anybody sleep. So, at a young age, he'd throw us in the car. If you wanted to spend time with dad, you were thrown in. I remember he had a station wagon back then, and we'd be out there, going to work with him. He'd find some work for us, whether it was making poultice for the horses when we were too young to mess with them, or picking up trash around the barns, or cleaning stalls, anything to keep us out of the house and around the farm. And the horses was instilled pretty young. And my grandfather, I was lucky enough, he passed away when I was 15, but he and my, took my cousins, Marshall and Brooks. We both had quite a bit of time with him, and another two part owners that are coming into the company, Alex and Logan Payne. And he'd get us up, take us to church, and then we'd be at the farm doing whatever, and really build a lot of camaraderie for this next generation, which I'm looking back now, I'm very grateful for. We had a good upbringing, and a lot of good stories to tell when we were young. And I think that's made us better going into this next generation. And my sister Katie as well. He really kept her involved with the horses, and that's how we all developed this passion that brought us into the next generation at TaylorMade.
And you grew up with Bowie clay and Epsom salts stuck to your nails, right?
But yep, that's pretty
Mixing that
accurate. Yes,
poultice.
sir.
But that's an interesting thing because a lot of that old time horsemanship, when you and I are talking, you guys are still doing really good basic horsemanship. And I think that may be part of the key to success.
Absolutely. I mean, we're a firm believer, put your hands on them and you teach them good temperament and everything. But a lot of these horses are best off spending as much time as possible in a field, just being horses and going through the pecking order and everything like that.
Now, we've talked about your nuclear family. A few years ago, Frank, you decided that you were going to expand the family with a program called Stable Recovery. And I'm just so proud to know you because you started that. Tell some of the people that aren't familiar with it what Stable Recovery is.
Part of the culture of TaylorMade and our family growing up was you worked very hard and then you played very hard. And that entailed a lot of drinking and just that was just part of the culture and the nature, and we had a lot of fun doing that. There was definitely some downside to it. Me personally, I drank for 5 decades, and I would describe myself as a functioning alcoholic, and I had, I was successful in every realm of life, but it just got to where I was miserable because of the drinking. And miraculously, I said I was going to quit about 5 years ago, and I did. And then part of working the steps and getting sober is you need to help other people work the steps and get sober. And so all this thing kind of came together. It really started, the essence of it started because I was when I started this, I was looking for more employees, and it was kind of a spiritual God thing that unfolded. And I went to this restaurant here in town called Deviate Kitchen, and I was amazed by the food and the service, and I got to talking to the owner, Rob Perez, and he's a recovering alcoholic. And I said, "Man, you got good food and good help. How do you get that?" He said, "Well, I only work people that are in recovery." And He said it works amazing. He said, Frank, you know, me and you run businesses and we hire people and we hire out of a certain segment of society. And there's a lot of addiction in the segment we hire out of. And he said, so I look at it like this. He said, do I want to hire out of the treated group or the untreated group? And that was like really mind blowing to me to look at it like that, because most farm owners, business owners, they'll even advertise, we're not hiring a felon, we're not hiring an alcoholic, we're not hiring a drug addict. But this guy looked at it differently and he took a different approach, and it was obvious that it was working. And he said, Frank, you'll find out when you save these guys' lives and you give them purposeful work and you give them a ladder out of the misery they're in, that they're going to develop certain characteristics and their characteristics that are great to have on any team. He said they're going to be honest, they're going to be hardworking, they're going to be loyal, they're going to be grateful, and they're going to want to help others. And he said, when you get those kind of characteristics in a workforce and in a team and in a culture, he said, it's just amazing. So he told me that, and I didn't know if I wanted to believe that or not, but now that we've been doing this for 5 years, he is absolutely true. He's right on point. And, you know, I think that Stable Recovery's had about 120 people go through it. Every one of them have gotten a job. Our success rate is through the roof. Like, average success rate in the industry is about 15% staying sober. And, you know, our numbers are up like three or four times that. So it's really... it's amazing how this is all unfolded. And so we have the TaylorMade School of Horsemanship. That's a 90-day program, teaches them the basics of horsemanship. And then we have Stable Recovery is providing the housing and paying them the first 90 days and teaching them the 12 steps and giving them a lot of discipline, structure, and responsibility and drug testing. And we're just having phenomenal results. You know, we see guys like Will Walden, who's stable, won $6.5 million last year, and he's got like 65 horses in training, and he's winning a lot of races. And then we've got a lot of people that have come through our program, like Mike Lowry, who never touched a horse 6 years ago, and now he's managing 250 horses and 25 employees. And you know, it's just there's a lot of success stories. And I really think that this is a breakthrough that can really change the world. You know, there's 48.5 million addicted people in America, and we have that big problem and issue, and this is the answer to helping that. And then we also have a huge labor shortage. So if you can bring these people out of the addiction into training and purposeful work and sobriety, then you change, you start solving most of the issues that our society faces. You know, it helps with homelessness, it helps with incarceration, it helps with addiction, it develops workforce, it reunites families. It's the answer. And it's just getting started, but it's really starting to roll now. And I think in 10 years from now, it may be all over the country.
Jill, it's hard to believe it's only 5 years.
Yeah. And it was, we had no clue of what we were doing either. It was just like,
I heard that your family said when you proposed it, do you remember? I'm sure you would like to tell us what they said to you.
Well, you know, I got great brothers and they're good businessmen, and they're conservative, and they look at the downside, you know. And so, you know, I'm a little different. I'm more of like, shoot, aim, fire, you know, fire, aim, shoot. But I kind of just go after it, you know. But there, so I came in there and I said, "Hey, you know, I got this great idea. I want to bring in some alcoholics and some heroin addicts and some meth addicts and some felons, and we'll have them work with these horses." And they like, "Have you lost your mind?" And so they obviously there was a lot of risk to it, and there was a lot of concern. So before the meeting was over, I talked them into giving me a 90-day trial, and then it went 90 days, and everything went great, and it's just built momentum from there. So I got to really give it to them. That was that was a big risk we took, but they were willing to do it.
You use the quote by Winston Churchill, which I love. Would you like to tell everyone that?
Yeah, Winston Churchill said the outside of a horse is good for the inside of a man. And you know, that is so true. You know, since we started Stable Recovery, and I've started seeing all these guys that come in here, and women that are totally broken, a lot of them suicidal, they're just down and out. And then you put them in a family atmosphere and you support them, and then you expose them to a horse. It's just absolutely miraculous what these horses do for these people. And you know, honestly, I took that for granted because I was born around a horse, and I was just interacted with a horse. So I never knew, I really never knew the power of it, because I just thought that's the way life was. But and another thing I always observed growing up is the best horsemen I was ever around were all alcoholics and drug addicts. And I used to I surmise that, you know, well, the reason they are is because they're stuck in a position as a groom or whatever, and they're around horses longer than somebody that's successful and moves up. But that was wrong. That was a wrong assumption. What the truth is that there's some kind of phenomenon or relationship about a broken person and a horse can relate to each other, and bond with each other and build a relationship that's actually better than somebody that is not broken. The horse has some kind of magical powers that can sense a broken person and can relate to that person, and that broken person can relate to that horse, and there's just this magical healing that takes place. And you know, my belief is that, you know, there wasn't as much mental illness and there wasn't as much addiction and problems, I don't believe, 150 years ago as there is today. And you can attribute it to a lot of things: breakdown of the family, drugs, alcohol, all these things. But also, people aren't exposed on a daily basis to a horse like they used to be. You know, instead of going and getting in your car, you went and got on your horse, and that was therapy time that a lot of people don't get today. So it's my belief that if we can get these horses, as many of these horses as possible, into therapeutic positions, and that's working with autistic kids, soldiers with PTSD, people with addiction problems, we need to get these horses exposed to people, and it'll help us a lot with this mental illness and therapy. And like I jokingly say, but it's true, you know, every morning you wake up at TaylorMade, there's 750 free therapists out here ready to go to work. And I really believe that. And I've got like, I really just think that basically you need to try to figure out a way to get broken people exposed to horses, because they heal each other. And so one thing, I don't know if I've told you, Les, but I've read where RFK, and head of the Human Health and Services, he's a recovering heroin addict, and the way he got sober was he went and worked on a farm and worked the 12 steps and got sober. So he's a big believer in farming and working and working the 12 steps. And he's proposed that he wants to start 200 healing farms across America that will grow organic vegetables and take people that are in addiction and put them on those places, rather maybe send a guy that's a nonviolent guy to jail that's got an addiction problem, send him to one of these farms and teach him how a skill of raising organic vegetables where he can get a job and he can be in a healthy environment and get sober. Which I think that's a fantastic
idea. That's a great idea.
Yeah, I remember you telling us that you were just proposing that.
But my idea, which I'm still in the process of getting a meeting with him, Andy Barr's helping me with that. And when I do get to meet with him and talk to him, what I'm going to propose is that on those 200 farms that we put a 20-stall horse barn on every one of them and get these people exposed to these horses, and the healing will be a lot better and a lot faster than just growing vegetables.
What a great idea. That's
and
a great idea.
There's so many positives to that. You know, I'm going to try to get it if it ever happens. It's just a dream at this point. But if it happens, for us to supply those farms with retired racehorses.
Exactly.
So then that gives a purpose. Again, that creates 4,000 spots to use retired horses to use in therapy with people. I think it's a no brainer. It'll help us place a lot of horses in useful spots and give them a good life. And plus it'll help the healing of the people in addiction. And not only that, but then you have basically 200 schools across the country teaching horsemanship that can produce workers to come into the industry. So
that's so important. People overlook that value of what you're doing with your program.
Yeah, well, there's just there we're on to something that's and it's been God's had his hands on everything we've done, and it's just like if you're in my spot and you can see what's happening, it's like these miracles are happening on a daily basis, and it's just crazy.
I'm really impressed that there were so many older people that you saw that were in recovery. Like, you don't give up on anybody. And I think that's one of the things that so many people try and hide addiction or send somebody away to a fancy place so nobody knows. And I know some people that have just given up on their children, which is so sad for me. Oh, we've tried that, you know, but you really don't give up on anyone.
No, we all you have to do to get into stable recovery is to be desperate and willing to do what we tell you to do. And if you'll do that, then you can be successful. And we want to have you in the program, but you can't help somebody that's not ready to be helped. If they're coming there because their mom's making them do it, or their wife, or they're really not doing it for themselves and they're not broken enough, then you can't really fix them. And what you're saying about, you know, families abandoning people, that is terrible. But on the flip side of that, so many times they love them to death. They just cannot let them hit rock bottom. And so they're always bailing them out and they're enabling them. And that keeps people from healing and getting better.
And that's one of the neat things about your program, because you're teaching people to be independent.
Well,
good.
You know, a lot of these people come in here. Some people come from wealthy families, some come from poor families. It you know, addiction does not discriminate, but the more, you know, there's a lot of these people that come in here that are from families that are generationally addicted. So their great grandfather, their father, their everybody's been addicted. So they don't know how to live sober. And and they haven't learned life skills that will allow them to be successful down the road. So you can't just teach a guy to get sober and not give him a job and not give him skills to survive and to succeed and get him in an environment that is totally different than what he is. Like these programs that get people sober 30, 60, 90 days and don't teach them anything or teach them how to live or teach them how to be responsible, and then they graduate them and they got a little bit of sobriety under them. Well, they go right back to the same town without a job and a lot of time on their hands. And it's just a matter of days till they're using again or drinking or not doing something. So we give them that sobriety over the first 90 days, but we at the whole time they're in a loving family that is holding them accountable. And then it's a 90-day program, but we want everybody to stay at least a year. And if they need to stay 5 years, that's fine too, because everybody gets sober at a different rate. But it's all about keeping them in the right environment. And I read one time where it said, you're basically an average of the five people you spend the most time with. So if you're going to spend the time with a bunch of guys that are using drugs and drinking and not doing well, that's what you're going to do, or if criminals. But if you're around a bunch of guys that are all trying to get sober and get better and become the best versions of themselves and help other people, well, then that's what you're going to become. And that's what's happening with our program is like I tell you, you can't describe it until you've been in one of these AA meetings or 12-step meetings and you see. But like, I was in one the other night, and we had 70 people jam-packed in a room, all from either graduates of stable recovery or in stable recovery. And there was one new guy in that room that showed up the first day. And everybody in that room knows that the most important guy in that room is the guy that just got there, because he needs the most help. And it took a long time, but we have a policy when somebody starts, everybody in the room welcomes them and thanks them and welcomes them to the family. So this guy showed up and he had 70 people take the time to say, you know, Bob, welcome to our family. We're glad you're here. He heard that from 70 different people. And you get those people exposed to something like that or broken, and it's just life changing for them. And then on that, you put them with a horse. So you got people that it's in a family, you're in a loving family, and everybody's working together. And then you put them with that horse and you give them purpose. It's just, it's just a formula to success.
Well, sobriety becomes very contagious in that environment.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. So what's the next step with stable recovery?
You know, I just don't know. It's blown my mind what's happened in five short years, and I don't know where it's going. It's going to go wherever God wants it to go. We're just trying to listen and follow instructions. But my prediction is that 10 years from now it'll be no worldwide, and it'll be all over the country. And it'll become the standard for helping people get sober and successful. And it's great. It's like tonight. This tonight at 6:30 on CBS. They're having a segment on stable recovery on the Eye on America.
Awesome.
That's at 6:30 tonight. So they came down here and shot for 3 days to do it, but. You know, whoever's listening, if they want to learn about stable recovery, they ought to go to the stable recovery website and look at some of the videos and look at some of the information there. It's really amazing what is transpiring. And, you know, there's no losers in this thing. Everybody's a winner, you know, it's just a miracle that's taking place. And you know, it's like you just see the effect. It's not just when you get somebody sober, but then you see them get it sober and then they start affecting. Like I got one guy Mike Lowry, they got sober, and his family had a lot of addiction problem. Then his little brother, he was failing out of high school and had some issues, and then he mentored him. Then he got sober, and he started getting straight A's in school, and then he came to work at TaylorMade, and now that kid's just graduated from high school, and he's got a scholarship to go into heavy equipment operation. They're going to pay him to teach him to do that. And then Mike's got he came to work at TaylorMade, and now he's a manager, and he has a farm, has a house on the farm, and he got his kids back, and they moved out of the inner city of Lexington, and now they live on a beautiful horse farm, and they're around on the farm going to work with him a lot, and seeing. So it's not just the person that you're helping, but the ripple effect that you have on the whole family. That's what's powerful. So if you get 1,000 people sober and successful, that's going to affect maybe another 10,000.
Exactly.
And the generation that comes afterward.
Yeah,
It's not
exactly.
the handing me down the addiction.
Exactly.
It's incredible that you've come up with this, but as you're talking, I'm thinking back to what we said at the beginning of the show about family, your mom going to church, you guys going to church. It all ties together, and I'm certainly not the most religious guy or spiritual guy in the world, but when you really look at it, it's a path that almost was laid out for you.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt that having spirit, having a successful grandparents and parents leads to your chances of being successful. That those blessings are handed down from generation to generation, and if it goes the other ways, those curses are passed down from generation to generation. So when you break the cycle and you get it going back again, as some amazing things can happen. And I just it's just amazing what has happened here, and God has put in place and given us an answer on how to solve this problem. And it's all about giving back and doing the right things. And my mom and dad told us a lot of lessons and repeated it, drilled it into us. But my dad would tell this story all the time, that he was going to church, and him and my mom were going to a place called Christ the King Cathedral, and it was just a tent out in a field that started out. Now it's a huge cathedral. But my dad said had eight kids, and I was basically broke, and I was living on a farm manager's salary, and we could barely feed the kids. And then the priest there at the church called my dad and mama over to the side one day, and he said, "Look," said, "I need y'all to start tithing. I need you to give 10% of what you're earning to the church." And my dad said, "I almost laughed. I was so broke." But they went home and talked about it and prayed about it, and they came back and told him, said, "Look, we're not going to say we're going to do it, but we're going to say we're going to try like hell to do it." And he said they started doing it, and they made the first couple of payments, and he said from that moment on, money was never a problem for him. It just started flowing in. He said Mr. Gaines put him in on some mare, and he made $2,000 or $3,000 like within a month, and then he got in another deal, and things just started happening his way. And he said it was like flipping on a light switch. Once he started tithing and giving back, it just started coming back to him. And he said from that point on, I never had financial worries ever again.
And obviously, you're following in his footsteps there as well. This has been enlightening, and I know Laura's enjoying the conversation. Joe, this is the most quiet you have ever been since we've
Yeah.
known you.
Excuse me. I'm sorry.
We're going to get Joe on by himself one of these days. Guys.
Sir.
You know what? I really appreciate it, and I appreciate your friendship. But more importantly, I appreciate what you're doing for all these people. You guys are an amazing family, and we're so proud to know you.
Well,
Feel the same way, and thank you for all you've done for us. I've learned a lot in our conversations, Les, and look
mostly
forward to a
not
lot more.
useful. You may have learned a lot, but none of this can be put to use. So.
Hey, Les, I have a tendency, as you can see, to talk a lot, so I got to tell a funny story.
Okay, go ahead.
The gala, we had a stable recovery gala, our second one, and it went really well. And so we took a poll after the gala, the second gala, and they said, well, it was absolutely awesome, but the common theme was how can we improve? And they said, well, Frank needs to talk less. And so I got a little offended, and I said, well, that's it. I'm not even going to talk at this next one. We got six speakers. I'm not going to say a word. I said, oh, you need to say something. I said, nope, I'm not saying a word. So anyway, the night came up for the rehearsal. And they said, well, you need to be there at 6 o'clock for the rehearsal. And I said, well, I don't need to come to rehearsal. I'm not talking. They said, we think you need to come and practice not talking.
But now the big question on Action News is, did you not talk?
You know what? I didn't. I didn't talk. I
I
talked a lot at my table, but I wasn't up in front of everybody.
okay. Well, guys, again, thanks for joining us. Continued success both with the farm, which is the sale was unbelievable. I'm sure October is going to be equally as good for you. Continued success with the stallions, but more importantly, continued success with what you're doing for all these human beings. And it's been a pleasure for Alora and myself. Thank you for joining us on the Equisport News Thoroughbred Report.
But,